What did you read this week?
Well, I read The Medium and the Light.
Ah, that must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was. And then I also read some stuff on Wyndham Lewis. I wanted to talk about Wyndham Lewis. And read Tar, although I didn't think that was... It got me interested in Wyndham Lewis, and I did read some stuff, and I do want to talk about him. But I didn't love that as a novel.
Work. Okay.
I mean, it worked, but I just... To just sit and read it as a novel, I didn't enjoy it like a novel that was written today. But we can talk about all that.
Right.
So I don't know where you want to start. Do you want to start with The Medium and the Light?
What is on your mind that you want to talk about first? Whatever you lead. What's right now?
Okay, well, we'll talk. What's that?
At this moment, what do you feel like talking about? We go with
that. I want to talk about The Medium and the Light.
Okay, good. His religion.
Okay. So, have you read that one?
Yes.
Do you have that book? Okay, because
yes,
I don't think there's a whole lot of copies of that. That one was hard to get. There weren't even very many copies on Amazon. I don't think that one probably sold a whole lot.
Right. The articles that are featured in it, I had knew the articles many years ago. So I read half the book, 30, 40 years ago.
But when it was published in other places.
Yeah, the interviews with Pierre Babin, B-A-B-I-N, however you say that guy's name, that priest,
right.
They were not available, and they were interesting, and they were done in the 70s. I think I knew they were being done. I knew McLuhan was being interviewed by a priest, and that was interesting to us because here's McLuhan as a Catholic being confronted by a priest, in the priest world. And what does McLuhan say to him? And that's what made that interesting. So the book was good for releasing those interviews.
Yeah. So we can just kind of go through. I took notes on various things. It was a really good compilation of a lot of McLuhan's ideas in here. Now, it was set against, the ground would be, he was kind of talking about what the church should do about some of these issues.
Right.
But you didn't have to read it in that context. I mean, if the Catholic Church part wasn't interesting to you, it was still all of McLuhan's points that were brought up really concisely. And, yeah. I mean, this would be a great book to give somebody that had all the major stuff in here, which I really like that, too.
You mean an introductory book? A great introductory book?
I wouldn't necessarily say introductory per se, but just if you want one slim volume that's going to have all the major points discussed at one point or another, this really does contain everything.
Yeah.
Which I thought
and
was good
it tells
too.
You, and it gets him talking about his personal religion, which in his more public part of himself when he was famous, he would not talk about. He wouldn't talk about it. He would say his personal religion was all irrelevant to the issues that he was talking about. But so this book has his collective corporate issues, but it has his personal stuff in there. So that's why it'd be extra interesting.
And so much of it, of course, was letters, and I just thought that was so interesting. Really at a time when no one writes letters anymore.
Right.
But that was still his major mode of communication with people close to him, his wife being one. So,
and he would spell a lot out. He would spell, like, he said letters are expository, like letters to editor, where you personally lay out, in that context, your personal opinion. Doesn't mean that there is any personal opinion or a personal McLuhan when he gets into Collective Electric Media. There is no private McLuhan there. They're not connected. But if he puts on a letter, a personal communication, he will get very personal and actually quite forthcoming. But you have to, you say, here's the thing. Don't think that you're learning about him. Oh, here's what he is. No, that's the way he is when he's pretending to be private because the situation, the medium evokes privacy. See? That's what you have to start noticing. He's acting in different media differently.
Okay. That makes sense. So
yeah,
he
gets on the electric media, he's not a Catholic. When he gets interviewed on TV or major networks, he's not a Catholic in that moment. See, that's what the... How can this guy be a Catholic one day and then not... You start learning how he's different in different media. Now, that's... No one ever did that ever before. There never was that many media to do it in.
Right.
So we got your first wow? You just said wow?
Yeah, that was my first wow.
Just 5 minutes. You would want to find out about his personal self, and you enjoy this book with the letters and think you're finding out his personal stuff, and you are. But it's a lot more complex than that, which I just spelled out, and that had not occurred to you. That's why it was a wow. But that's the big wow.
Right, because I thought it was all, I was learning all about him.
Yeah. That's right. Exactly. I thought I was learning all about him. Very good. Okay,
yeah.
But let's pretend we're learning all about him and go into the details of what it is that's interesting.
Okay, so let's go into the details. So I loved the letter that he wrote to his wife, Corinne Lewis.
Yes.
When they were courting, yes.
You know, just start. They weren't
yes,
married
he's
yet.
Talking about whether he'd be a suitable husband to her. And it's just so clear, like, you know, you wonder who would Marshall McLuhan be married to, and would he have intellectual conversations with, you know, his wife, and would she be his intellectual equal? And, I mean, certainly she was. He was bouncing ideas off her.
Do you know how they met? Do you know the context of how they met?
No.
His mother taught at Pasadena, California Theater School, whatever school was going on in Pasadena, in 37, 38, 39. So Marshall, I don't know if he wanted to be with his mother or it was a happy coincidence, but he went out to California, to L.A. area, to study some paintings at the Huntington Museum or something. So his mother was out there. So he gets to hang out with his mother. And his mother schemes and plots to introduce her brightest student, Corinne Lewis. Corinne Lewis, that's going to be his wife, plots to get them to meet each other. And they do. And she's really pretty and everything. So Marshall falls for her. And I think he corresponds with her for through 38 into 39. Then they get together up in St. Louis where McLuhan was working and she was down in Texas, and he basically what do you call that, abduct, what's that word, elope, abduct, he has a very aggressive approach to her. Because he's going to go to England. World War II is going to break out, but let's say they didn't know that. So in the summer he's going to go there in August, September 39, spend a year or two, 10 months or something. So he gives her I don't think they spend that much time together up to that point. They've been writing to each other. He gives her an ultimatum. Either marry me and come, or that's it. And she goes
really?
Back home. Yeah, and she kind of goes back home, but then halfway home or something, comes back or doesn't get out the door. And so they go down. Now, she's from a very proper, you know, upper middle class family, I think. And they just quickly go to the local civil thing and have a civil marriage and go over to Europe and send a phone call to her parents. You know, that really, I think, shocked the parents the way how it turned out. No proper family wedding, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we hijacked her. So then she was stuck in England with them for a year. And I've talked to talked to people who knew her, and I knew her and all this stuff, talked to her both through the Evergreens and this and that, but the Evergreens point out that she was really important in the early years. She knew the grammar because she was learning to be an actress at the Pasadena Playhouse. So she was cultured, pretty cultured herself, and pretty smart. And she was a really major influence or assistance in the early years. Really important. So, yes, she was not a passive housewife or something. She was an intellectual.
No.
She was involved. And she's also... He's gradually trying to get her to convert, and she didn't convert until a few years later.
Well, that wasn't clear, actually, anywhere, whether she had or not.
Right.
So,
well, if you're interested in the thing, read a biography or two eventually and get those details.
Oh, yeah. And he loves her letters. Like, he's begging her to write more to him. And it was a neat time. Like, on the one hand, he's getting into and talking about electric culture, and he's still very much in manuscript culture himself with the writing.
Yeah.
So I'm sure this was all with a pen. This wasn't even at a typewriter.
Right.
So then in this letter, he's talking, you know, right out of the gate here about spiritual acts. So he's talking about the sacraments, and it seemed throughout. Now, there's a couple places we'll talk as we talk about the various essays where, I mean, he's really into this whole, supernatural aspect of the church and how the Catholic Church is so important because of these spiritual acts. And he's talking about Christ liquidating all human sins for all time and how we owe all goodness to God's mercy. And the Catholic is venerating the signs of God's favor towards a creature. And, you know, does talk about Catholics thinking of God as a friend and not having any fear toward God. But all really such Orthodox Christian stuff. I mean, I was surprised to know that that's what McLuhan not only believed, but felt like he, like, converted, you know, was brought on his knees to believing.
Right.
Now, is he kidding about that? Or you were talking about this being kind of, I guess, maybe a satire, a put on. I mean, is that all a put on? Or?
I don't think so. There may have been a strategy. Like, he knew, he was already a guru in his own mind. He knew he wasn't going to have a life unless he fucking changed the world. You know what I mean? He was on a mission very early. That's what's incredible. He's writing these, like, mission statements to his wife, and they're courting, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, it's like bumping into me. It's like if Carol met me tomorrow, and I explained, well, we're doing the RNA drops, we got the cold fusion battery, everything I was trying to tell Harold, and if you're going to hang out here, then you're going to have to get with this program. You know, that's what he was doing to her, right? And, she says, some of the interviews with her are interesting. She says, when I met him, he was the weirdest bird. This is the actual word she says. He was the weirdest bird I'd ever met. Like, he was a weird guy. He's so serious.
Yeah.
So into it. And so while he's writing these very Christian, you know, what do you call that, normal, corny, religious stuff, he's reading Wyndham Lewis and Finnings Wake and all these amazing other intellectual stuff. You see what I mean? He's schizoid. He's living two lives.
Yeah.
So, yes, you could say, well, he's putting it on. No, he is intellectually trying to figure out something. And so he eventually says that, and this is 40 years later in the 70s, there's a good interview online somewhere where he goes into a bit of details. He says, Catholics who were born into Catholicism, they know the dogma. They learn it in school or however they learn it. And he says those that weren't born into Catholicism are different. They either go and learn the dogma and then accept it intellectually. But he said he didn't do that. He was challenged by some people at either in Madison, Wisconsin, you know, RNA drops distribution, challenged there, or at Cambridge. You're always talking about Catholic philosophy. Why aren't you a Catholic? And he said he didn't have an answer for that. So he started to see if he could get a sign from God proving that there was something to the Catholicism. Yeah. He says he demanded this. And he pounded on the walls, and he got a sign. And he apparently doesn't tell us what the sign was. But he said he came into the church on his knees praying and begging for a sign, not through the concepts, not through the ideology. So he said, I don't know anything about he didn't know anything about the theology. He didn't even really know what conceptually he didn't care. He was actually trying to have a psychic experience, it sounds like.
Right.
And he got one. Yeah.
But lots of signs. He said he got lots and lots of signs.
Like people listening to Ion and then start looking for anomalies.
Right.
For signs.
I mean, it seemed like he was so hungry for something that was ion, and then he just like projected that onto Catholicism. To me, but I could be re-premiering my whole, like, I don't know, but that's what I was thinking when I was reading this. Okay, so a couple other little things.
Oh, it's true. When I talked to people, his assistant, people who knew him, they'd say, but Clulin wasn't a Catholic. You line him up against a thousand Catholics, he's not like anybody. There's something different. He's actually infiltrating Catholicism to fucking change it. He's actually a saint. He's like Jesus, you know, going to change the Hebrew religion.
He wanted the mystic aspect of it and the sacrament. Like, transubstantiation, there was nothing in here about what he thought about that. But I would have loved to ask him, like, what do you think of that? Because, I mean, he wanted
to
drop.
He had no problem with that. I think I've seen him write a bit about that, some of these obscure essays. Oh, yeah, he agrees with it.
Did he take it literally?
Yes, and he would put that as that's what happens in the act of cognition and perception. The very act of perception is a transubstantiation of the external world. So he would put it into psychological processes or perceptual processes. That's what's very interesting is that he's learning the Catholic metaphor for St. Thomas Aquinas, and then he's going to use it in his writings. He's going to make a big metaphor. He goes on about the incarnation mimes a drama of cognition. So Jesus coming into being, the Son of God, and walking around was miming the actual process of the interaction of your senses, which is pretty amazing. You have to study
it
and get what he means about it, but that's what he was doing. He was so in that way, he infiltrated the church, and he was going to change it.
Right.
And he came up with the media philosophy.
He must have felt called to, because he's always talking about, all through this, about things being like divine providence. And how, I mean, he loves all the drama of it, that every moment in the church is played against a supernatural backdrop. Like, there's almost a Dan Brown-ish, like, he's living his own little angels and demons story.
Yeah. His own fantasy of what Catholicism was all about.
Yeah, he is, to me. There's, like, a fantastic aspect of it, which makes it really fun.
And okay, if he is a prophet of Ion, and he does, if we can retrospectively say that, then he knew there was something the church didn't get.
Yep.
You know what I mean? He wasn't going. There might have been a bit of mental comfort, but he actually is going in there to find out what's going on and maybe improve on it or complete something.
Right.
Yeah, that's where he's ionic.
Yeah, definitely. And it is kind of weird also, too, to read about the church from this completely non-conspiracy theory Illuminati perspective.
Right.
Because the Catholic Church, the Pope is always a reptilian, you know, they, right? And McLuhan's saying they're clueless.
They don't know about, the Pope doesn't know, they're an oral medium, and they blow it 400 years ago with the printing press. They didn't understand that, and they lost their power to the Protestant Empire, and then they don't understand the electric age. He's always writing in a lot of private essays about his main mission is to get Catholics out of their two normal perceptions. Their religion was not training their perception. Or something wasn't training them. They were all dummies. Yeah. That's where he was infiltrated.
And it might not be the perfect place to bring it up, but he talks about how in the global village, the most primal impulses and conflicts are retrieved. And so we're right back at Peter and Paul church.
See, he's saying, he's explaining, hey, you guys, we've got ourselves in a real problem here. There's a whole new dimension happening, and the church is going to have to deal with its relationship to it. And we're back. In other words, he's Jesus, and he's looking to see who's going to be Peter or is it going to be Paul, you know?
Right. And the liturgy goes into the left hemisphere of the brain and the...
Right.
Right. And then the... Yep. I forget how that goes, but we'll get to that because the left and the right hemisphere of the brain thing was really important in this, too. Okay, so that's really all I had to say about.
Were you raised as a Catholic?
I was, yep. And didn't say, because of course, go ahead.
Any of your fellow Catholics they weren't thinking about the church this way. This guy is agonizing, trying to figure out, hey, this church ain't going to exist. You know why it wasn't going to exist anymore? Because it was built on the phonetic alphabet, and electric age undermines the alphabet completely. Therefore, there's no foundation for the church anymore. Imagine telling that to your neighbors. You know, you go to church, and they're just looking for some kind of comfort or nonsense. And here's this guy probing. He used to confront the Catholic priest who taught in the Catholic University part of the University of Toronto, called St. Michael's College. He would confront these guys and interrogate them whether they really understood the new Thomistic aspects and all that. You know, he was very aggressive.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's just move on to that then, because he did, Chapter 4, Makers of the Modern World, Communication Media Makers of the Modern World, is an address that he gave at that St. Michael's College. That
in 1959, right?
Right, in 1959. And he just lays it all out for these guys.
Right, but at the very end, he says that Lewis had the message but didn't know how to work up Protestant fury. He said, you got to work up Protestant fury. You got to have a point of view. You got to have a value judgment. And Lewis had no value judgments, and therefore he failed. So he discusses Lewis right at the end to these priests. So he's looking at the artist, especially his main influence, Lewis. And then McLuhan himself actually repeats the same mistake. He says he goes in and revolutionizes public commentary by saying he's not going to use value judgments, which he said in Lewis's day was the wrong thing to do. But TV changed the situation where the Lewis method would work.
Yes. And I did mark to read that whole last paragraph. We might want to do that if you want to look at it.
Yeah, but let's go back to what you were saying. He covers the whole...
So how old are these seminarians at St. Michael's College?
No,
who
they're
are these?
Priests.
Are these young boys?
No, they're priests. It was a Catholic part.
Okay.
Yeah, University of Toronto had four or five colleges. There was the Presbyterian, the Methodist, the Anglican, something, and the United, and then the Catholic. The Catholic part was St. Michael's College, and they were run by the Basilian faction of the Catholic Church, who don't like the Jesuits. So you probably never heard of Basilians, but it was a Basilian school, a bit different.
Oh.
And I'm not familiar with what their position was. I know they were anti-Jesuit. So they're a faction within the Catholic Church. So he and Don Thiel are the only teachers, lay human, non-priest teachers at the school. So he's teaching around nuns and guys. And it's really interesting talking to these guys years later, what they thought of this McLuhan, you know what I mean? Some of them thought he was disgusting. Some thought he was a great guy and liked him, and he probably caused all kind of dissension in the college. But he says the true artist back in after World War II infiltrated decent society. The arts were obsolete. Being a writer, a novelist, all these things were obsolete. He knew that if he went into a major university institution, he had guaranteed audience, the students. He could perform every day, and also he was working on being respectable, but not too respectable. His mother got upset that he dropped his Baptist background and became a convert. She was really upset with that, because becoming a Catholic in Canada would lead nowhere. So he would be taking measures to undermine his career, while at the same time making sure he got the basics, like getting a PhD in that. You know what I mean? He worked on several levels. This is where we get into quadrophenia.
Right.
So I tend to go on. I want you to talk a bit more. I go on in answering, but you probably
No, you're fine, and I love what you're saying, and I'm hesitating a little bit, but at some point I really want to talk about the Code of a Herdsman, and I'm just wondering if some of that plays into the way McLuhan acted.
You're
talking about...
This is probably
how
a good
he,
you mentioned
to
you
talk
had,
about that now.
Let's talk about Wyndham Lewis, Lemuel in Lilliput. You wanted to talk about that essay he writes in 1944 about. He's just met Lewis. He's read Lewis in the 30s. Now he meets him in 43 in Detroit, Windsor area.
Okay, say these dates again. When did he meet him?
1943, during the war. Wyndham Lewis had left England. He wrote against possible World War II coming for a decade or more. And when the war started, he said,
Wyndham Lewis
and he
was
left.
In his 60s? He was in his 60s then?
Let's see, yes. He would be 61.
And then how old was Marshall, 41?
He'd be 32. So twice, exactly twice older, you know, 30 and 60, so to speak.
Okay, because
McLuhan's 1911 and Wyndham is 1882. So they're twice as old.
All right.
And they meet, and Lewis already knows, and McLuhan already knows this guy's a genius. He's been reading him, and his mother was so smart, she told him, hey, Lewis is up here speaking. Like, so your grandmother wouldn't, I assume, wouldn't know about the importance of Wyndham Lewis in World War II, but Marshall's mother did.
No.
And told him, get your ass up here and meet this guy. And he did. And that was the big, so he spends a year.
So wait, let me ask this. So is that when Wyndham Lewis, is he writing his pamphlets then? And is he?
Oh, no, Lewis is a heavy. He's a big deal up there with Eliot and Joyce and Pound. He's a king. But he disgraces himself in the early 30s by writing that book about Hitler. And so by the end of the 30s, he leaves England because he may get arrested. Some of the fascists, the guys who led the fascist party in Britain, Oswald Mosley or whatever his name was, he led the party, which Lewis knew those guys and spoke at their parties. But, you know, Lewis was more than that. But anyways, he had obvious associations with the Nazi factions, the fascist factions in Britain, and some of them were being put in jail. So he got the hell out of the country. And he went to Canada.
What did he like about the Nazis? I was going to ask you that.
He didn't like them. We were going to read the Hitler book and still can read it, but Alan Mountain, the scholar in England, the Lewis scholar who's fought the good fight for Lewis for 40 years, he told me not to read the Lewis book on the Bobfest. I was going to do it, but he said, you will get a lot of headaches and you may not want to do it. And he knows this because he's been fighting the Lewis fight for decades. So I didn't read it yet. Now, we may eventually, but I didn't do it in the thing. So the Hitler book, Lewis, as I've explained, and McLuhan said, is interested in new phenomena. He doesn't like bourgeois culture. He's interested in anybody, right, left, or center, or anarchist, that's going to cause something to topple bourgeois culture. So the Nazis were the latest new thing in the early 30s. So he went and investigated them. So anyway... He wrote a book in 1939 called The Hitler Cult, you know, putting down that movement. It didn't work. Anyways, Lewis is very complex in the middle of all this. But he knew he had to get out of the country, and he wasn't going to go through another war. He lobbied against the potential war for 15 years, so why hang around? So he went to Canada, and that turned out to be terrible for him. Nobody knew him in Canada. He had no reputation, no money, nothing. The hotel that he stayed in burnt down, and McLuhan saved him from that. Point. In 43, Lewis was at the bottom. Nothing's happening. So McLuhan takes him to St. Louis, gives him painting commission jobs, including painting the head of Monsanto at that time. And so Marshall is absorbing Lewis for a year or so, and then he writes an amazing long article on Wyndham Lewis, Lemuel and Lilliput, where he takes a stance in the middle of the World War II. It's like me coming out right now and writing a big essay about, how great Osama bin Laden is. You see what I'm saying? It's talking about a guy who had a public image in England, probably didn't have any image in North America because nobody knew about him, other than the professors, but a public image who was in a bad guy to support, and he comes out and says, this guy's where it's at. And it's the beginning of his media philosophy is stated in that article.
Wow. Okay.
And I just finished this week reading Don Thiel's great book on McLuhan, the first one he did. The Medium is a Rearview Mirror. And Don goes on proving that Lewis is the main background to McLuhan, to what he was working for, was working on behalf of Lewis, not James Joyce. So there's a big case.
Well, that's what he said. I mean, that's what Marshall said.
Yeah.
So
he would always,
and that's
every now and then. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Oh, I was just going to say, that's why Tar, which we'll talk about, that wasn't, I mean, I'm glad I read it, whatever, but, like, I'm way more interested in some other Lewis books now than that. I mean, it'd be
more
here's
what's important about Tar. Is that the characters, you have a German and a French and a different people from different parts of Europe. And Tar is, I guess, the British guy. It's a replay of Wyndham Lewis's travels in Europe before World War I, hanging out with the different art movements around Europe. So now he's going to write about what's the role of the artist in the middle of this technological juggernaut. So so what he did in the book is because he wrote the book before World War I, and it didn't get published till after it, I think. But it was he was predicting how. What would happen to Germany? What would happen to England and France? What happens to the characters and those national characters? The fate of them, including, forget the name of Chrysler. What's his name? Chrysler? Otto Chrysler is the German
Otto
guy.
Otto Chrysler, yeah.
Yeah. He's a guy out of control, right? He's out of sync with everything. He causes problems all over the place. He's Germany in the zeros up to 1910 and 11. So he's acting out. He's a character representing Germany. So Lewis really got it right, showing the public postures of the different countries leading into World War I. That's what many critics appreciate about the book. So we're not looking at it might be too philosophical, too abstract, and too sociological and political, and there might not be enough personal drama and sentiment going on because the characters are acting out, you know, public iconography. But that was pretty radical to do that.
I'm sure it was very radical, and it also was a satire. So
yeah,
you know, and it is kind of hard sometimes to really get that sort of humor when you don't really know what it was like to be in that time period. You know,
yeah, and that showed
but
you that.
I appreciated it. No, it really showed me that
the charisma, the charisma of the Russian woman. She's what everybody's after. She's got that in Russia. This is when, you know, you got the Russian ballet starts coming in, and you have the charisma of the Russian art movements and Dostoevsky and all the things. So she represents Russian, a different kind of mentality, being that just screws up the British and the Germans. You know, they can't take her. Tarr has a problem with her. Chrysler has a problem with her. They're all, you know, bumping around over her. Over Russia.
Okay, that makes sense.
And the German girl is just too old-fashioned or too lumpen, and so she gets raped.
Right.
Bertha.
So,
right, Bertha. That's your name.
Yeah, Lucan. Bertha Lucan.
So you have the important thing. The important thing is that Lewis is writing about the role of the artist in this new post-artistic Gutenberg world, post-Gutenberg world, and Joyce is doing it at the same time, and they're going to become, you know, involved with each other later. They're both writing about the artist. Joyce is the portrait of the artist as a young man, and they really do it differently.
Now, was Wyndham Lewis, was he considered like a hottie back then?
Was he a what?
Was he...
a hottie, did you say?
He was so hot, kind of like a Johnny Depp-ish type of guy.
Oh yeah, yeah. He was 6'1", 6'2" or something. Huge, big, charismatic, very handsome guy. And of course, who becomes one of many mistresses is the Queen of London Society, Lady Cunard. You know, the Cunard shipping line is the big company. And it's just like Downton Abbey, you know, the main woman and the daughter, the lead daughter, and all these guys are supering her. Yeah, Mary. Lady Cunard is the big prize, right? So everybody's working for her, and she ends up, you know, hanging out with Lewis. Lewis has her, and I think the story is at one time he's having sex with her, and he suddenly gets an idea for a painting, so he stops having sex, kicks her out of the house, doesn't even let her get a dress. She goes outside nude, and he gets into his painting.
Oh, my gosh. That's crazy.
Right.
Because I thought he looked kind of cute in some of his pictures.
He is. He looked just like Captain Beefheart. A young Captain Beefheart who loved Beef. He was one of the few writers Beefheart tolerated was Wyndham Lewis, and Wyndham Lewis looks just like Beefheart. They're interchangeable when they're in their 20s or so.
Okay. Okay, so then...
And he had many, many women. I mean, he was a womanizer. I mean, one woman got pregnant. I think I told this before. Goes to the hospital, has the baby, comes back to show him the baby, and he won't let her in because he's fucking someone else. He didn't even care about his baby.
No, he didn't. All right, so this Code of the Herdsman, if this seemed to be like a way that an artist should live so that they can bear to be here.
Among the herd,
kind of thing.
Yes.
Among the herd, right?
The code of the guy who's smarter than the little man. You know, read it that way. And he's describing how to live among the little men, which is in the Emerald Tablets. You know, you got to be very careful among these little men.
Yeah. Now, what did people think about that when they, did they think he was arrogant?
Yeah, people didn't, they didn't understand Lewis. As a matter of fact, McLuhan says that Lewis will never be popular. He's too smart, too advanced. And McLuhan knew that was McLuhan's own fate. He would never be popular. But what was different, it was a different time. McLuhan actually became an icon for some level, but he was never understood the way Marshall wanted to be understood. But Lewis, he became reasonably famous in London, but as an outsider, he was never discussed as a positive force like McLuhan was. See, McLuhan redid Lewis, as it shows on my chart. He redid Lewis in a better way, in a better time to pull Lewis off, because the media situation was different.
Right. Well, it seems, too, like Lewis was giving a lot more prescription and advice for, like, how to live. And Marshall just didn't
yes.
do that. That
That's
might
right.
have made him unpopular also.
Yeah.
Because he was...
Well, people who knew Lewis, in the art world, everybody knows everybody over there, they knew what from normal values what a maniac Lewis was. You know what I mean? Everybody was afraid of him.
Right.
And he put it on by calling himself the enemy.
Right.
And now McLuhan, he's being quietly interviewed for a CBC documentary in the 67, and they ask him... I think he's on a subway car while doing this. They ask him, what is his motive? What's he up to? He says, well, look at me as someone who's sort of like the enemy of the society. He says it very quietly, but he says it. I'm the enemy. And that's my motive. So he just redoes Lewis, but it's a different time, a different context, and he says it differently. He just says it in passing. He doesn't start a journal called The Enemy, which is what Lewis did.
Right. Okay, so we should look at this essay then. The Lemuel and Lilliput. What, too?
Yeah.
So Lemuel is the guy in Lilliput, right?
Yes, it's Gulliver. It's Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travel, and it's the part where the guy's a giant among the little tiny people. The Lilliputians are tiny, and Gulliver is someone called Lemuel, who is huge.
Right. Okay, so there's a lot in this. This is a long essay,
yeah.
And there's a lot of stuff in here. And he's talking
about... Were you able
about
to understand it as you read it, or did you have to reread lines? I mean...
I had to reread this about three times, this one in particular.
Yeah.
And I still don't think... I think this is like my Da Vinci Holmes.
Yeah.
Chapter in here. I don't know... if I got it all, let me turn to my notes in here, too, on this chapter. You know, in that one chapter we didn't talk about, because we went off on the Code of the Herdsman, we might have to go back to that at some point in this discussion on Lemuel and Lilliput about art being, like, the thingness in art.
Yes.
I don't know if that's a concept that we need to have for this chapter.
But what it means, he's talking about when a new object, a new environment happens, people don't know what it is. What is ion? Ion's a thing, a pterodactyl. We don't even have a word for the environmental aspects of ion, right? And so it's a thing. And so new art, which is, you know, altering people's perceptions and new media, have thingness. And you'll see Marshall talks about that in Understanding Media. He replays it's like the code word. When you want to talk about the real present and how hard it is to understand it, it's a thing.
Right. And I'd say that word, people use that word a lot now. Maybe it's just continued on, or maybe it's kind of back now, because there are so many more things. you know?
Yeah, actually, you could say that the object has so cluttered that people actually took on the proper word thingness. There are all these new things in your life that are altering you, you know, whether you're buying a new kind of a kitchen utensil or something. You see that in Downton Abbey. The sewing machine shows up and radically threatens everybody, you know? Electric sewing machine.
Right.
So that's a new thing. But nowadays we have so many environments, which is in cliched archetype, that everybody is repeating Lewis but just seeing it all around them and kind of numb before it.
Right.
Before all the thingness. But yeah, you're right. The word became the right word because of the way the artist used it or Lewis used it.
Okay. So this whole, you might have to help me with some of this. So this whole chapter or essay here is it embellishing or augmenting the code of the herdsman, how to live among the little people?
Yes.
He's talking about his pamphlet, The Art of Being Ruled. He's talking about how it's such a period of change right now that things will never, ever, ever be the same.
The old responses don't work. And he's saying Lewis is a pioneer of coming up with new responses to the thing, the new thing,
okay,
the new environment.
Okay. And then he goes on to talk about all serious writing being done for professionals.
By professionals.
By professionals for professionals, that there really isn't a serious reading public at all.
Right, that you're not a serious writer unless you're living by your earning power and you're not affiliated with any political group. Most writers were hacking along, aligned with some political group, and get supported that way by ideologically agreeing critics and reviewers and that. And to be a real artist, you couldn't go that way. You couldn't, so since you couldn't have any group supporting you, you had to make a living. So you had to be a professional. You had to make a book and live by it, sell it.
And he's talking about these particular books being intended as aspirin. So that would just be like the books for entertainment then, correct?
Yes.
Just,
yeah, and you see that in Mechanical Bride. In Mechanical Bride, he calls it the book hour or the hour of the book, and McLuhan puts down all the novels and all that that are being sold.
Right.
That's all aspirin. Real perception is in a book like Mechanical Bride, which is not bought, hardly sold at all, hardly bought at all. It's not, it doesn't
right.
get into the aspirin.
And so I think this was the chapter two where I noticed McLuhan really talking about how illiterate people have become. Of course, everybody's still.
What he was saying is not illiterate, they become emotionally illiterate. Their emotions were not capable of responding clearly to the new things, the new media environments. And therefore, they're acting like children in response to the radio, movie, magazine, and pop culture. They had emotional illiteracy. And he was training a new kind of emotional maturity.
Oh, I didn't get that.
Yeah,
that's really
it's emotional. Yeah, it's not about being literate. The kids in school are not being trained and describe the environment they're living in. It's not being done accurately. It's all played through old book values. And that does not make a student mature emotionally to respond to the feelings you're going to get in the new media environment.
Okay. That makes sense. And then he's going on to talk about, and this seems kind of, I don't know what the word would be, but like how there are no benefactors at all from all of this, everything that's going on, art, entertainment, science, philosophy, everything that's going on in pop culture, that there aren't any beneficiaries in the modern world as a result of all of that.
Right. There's no benefits the way it is at that point.
And I didn't know what he meant by that. That seemed kind of
The disservices.
Nihilistic, right? What would that
no,
be?
No, he's saying the environment's nihilistic. He's saying the family has been destroyed. The human being
right.
is being prepared to be replaced. the human being is kaput, and the managers of society don't care. And so ultimately the disservices of the new technological progress are apocalyptic for people. And there's no beneficiaries of it in the long run, of what's happening.
Okay. Apocalyptic. I mean, that wasn't really the word that I was looking for, but that probably is the better word. And then there's the chapter on what we need is an apocalypse.
There's a chapter of what?
That's called What We Need is an Apocalypse.
Who writes that chapter?
Oh, this is in this book. It's
Oh, the Medium and the Light book. Yes, the Medium and the Light.
Yeah. So an apocalypse is a good thing in that sense.
Yes, it would. If you turned off the media, you'd wake up to what you've been emotionally illiterate about or immature about, and it would be painful and apocalyptic, but nothing's going to move to the services outweighing the disservices unless you have this dramatic penance, almost. This dramatic recognition of what the real implications. Like the church, he's saying the Roman Catholic Church, they better understand what's going on because their church's going to be obsolete. And it has happened. That has happened to the Roman Catholic Church and to a lot of the churches. But he's saying, you, if you don't control this media environment, new electric media environment, you cannot be viable. So that's Armageddon. That's an attack on you. And Apocalypse is recognizing that. And he says that all through the interview in Medium and Light, he talks about that, about the inadequacy of the church. With historical examples, you know, he goes through the history of media, the different changes.
Right. So let me ask this, it's kind of a non sequitur, but what was Nietzsche? What was his
You know, I heard McLuhan say after a Monday night seminar, he said to a professor, he said, Nietzsche, he studied the effects of media. He said that's what was, it's almost like the title, Beyond Good and Evil, means beyond usurious content issues, you know. Good, is that a good thing or a bad thing? To look at things beyond good and evil is to look at the forms, the media forms. So that's probably why McLuhan said Nietzsche was on to the new language, the new way of dealing with it. Not that, you know, McLuhan agreed with his value system or whatever, but he did compliment Nietzsche for, at least he did to this one prof in this room. Doesn't mean he'd do it 3 days later, but he said it in that context. I overheard him. So
okay.
He does generally in his letters, when he talks about Nietzsche, he's saying, you know, the effect of Nietzsche for people, they're Nietzscheans or nihilists. He's not for that. He doesn't think Nietzsche has a solution. But he said Nietzsche certainly was a genius looking at the new environment and the new problems coming up more than other people were.
Okay. So how much time did Marshall spend with Wyndham Lewis then? Was it like a
year or two in St. Louis?
Okay.
Lewis lived there. Marshall got him painting commissions, tried to get a couple of lectures. I think he even got to teach a little bit. And then Lewis went up to Windsor and taught a bit up there. There might have been a bit. If you read one of the biographies, Lewis was really hard to. He was dangerous as a friend. You never knew whether he's going to turn on you. And at some point, he turns on McLuhan. Gets paranoid, which might have been a result of the war wound, the blasting in the trenches in World War One. He might have had some kind of weird emotional vulnerability when things were, he couldn't handle stress. But who knows? The thing is that Lewis moved up north, and McLuhan, when he wrote that article in 1944, he moves up north to Windsor and gets a gig. He leaves St. Louis. So basically, as soon as he got involved with Lewis, he left the United States, moved to Canada, and they were going to start a new journal, pick up the enemy again, and go for the college market. They knew that there was a lot of smart kids in college who would respond to a journal of ideas. So when they got to, he gets up there in Canada, in Windsor, which is near where Chad grew up, Windsor and Detroit, all of a sudden the war ends and Lewis goes back to England. So the journal didn't happen. The war was over and McLuhan was stranded. So he got a job at the University of Toronto in 1946. And then I don't know if he corresponded right away, but eventually when Lewis put out a novel about his period when he was with McLuhan called Self-Condemned, the novel has McLuhan as a major character in the novel. That's when I think Marshall started corresponding with Lewis again. So I may be wrong. He might have corresponded a little bit, but they get back into it after a few years of not talking.
Okay.
So like anybody, if you read one of the biographies, Lewis had a problem with everybody he met.
People, yeah, there is an edge to him.
Yeah.
Kind of a bossy, snobby edge.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still really like him. I still really like him.
Well, he produces great work. You know, he's a bit like Zappa.
Yeah.
He makes incredible stuff. His snobbishness is justified.
Right. His pomposity.
Yeah. It's like they do in Hollywood. You know, stars are allowed to get away with stuff because they create supposedly great entertainment. So Lewis back then is on that level.
Right.
In the literary world.
Which was a really, I mean, we don't have a literary world like that anymore, do we?
No.
No.
And McLuhan used to point that out. And, you know, T.S. Eliot, you know, who was the respectable member of that gang of vortex people, he said that Lewis was the first writer in hundreds of years to revolutionize the English language. Now, that's quite a statement about a guy that most people didn't know what to make of and couldn't read his books.
In what way did he say he revolutionized the English language?
He created a whole new style. In a simple way, he wrote and described people as a painter would describe people. So a painter's looking at a person, and he's figuring out how to paint them with that trained eye. He would describe the environment and people in his novels like a painter would.
Right.
And that was different.
Right. Now I'm thinking of something, and I can't remember what chapter it was in. It was talking, it might even have been this one, talking about point of view versus, I think this is in the thingness of the art. I don't have a fully formed thought about it. But you know what I'm talking about? How in art, when people were painting, there have been times when point of view becomes really important and everybody rushes to paint what they see.
Oh, yeah, that's perspective coming in with the Renaissance.
Yes, yes.
And that's the artist, because that happened before the printing press became an environment. So McLuhan's principle, the artist is always, you know, well ahead of what changes are coming. So they start wanting to paint a point of view and perspective, which was what would be an effect of the print of book over the next couple of hundred years. People would develop a visual preference for a point of view and a perspective. Well, the movement of perspective in Italy was anticipating that, just like the painter Surratt anticipated the TV image. So that's McLuhan's point. He's going to show how the artist shows up and picks up on what's going on well before the technology comes in and then changes everybody's perceptual bias. And then they have to try to struggle to catch up or adapt to the new demand.
Right.
So when the printing presses have any effect, listen to this one. When printing presses have any effect, Shakespeare is taking the old medieval environments, all his plays are about the pre-print world, and it's kind of like nostalgia. And so he's using the pre-print world that people are nostalgic for in all his plays, so he takes the past that everybody was trying to save as a metaphor for what was going on in the present.